Chapter 10. Mama. 2 years later, Gutierrez shut her eyes at the memory. "Do you have the document?" I asked. She opened her eyes, stared at me. "I promise you," I said, "I will only use anything I learn here today in a way you're comfortable with, even if it means giving up the story." She picked up a white iPhone, began clicking and scrolling. She pushed the phone across to me, letting me read the $1 million non-disclosure agreement. The document was 18 pages long. It was signed on the last page by Gutierrez and Weinstein. The lawyers involved in drafting it must have been so convinced of its enforceability that they never considered the possibility of it emerging. The contract ordered the destruction of all copies of audio recordings of Weinstein admitting to the groping. Gutierrez agreed to give her phone and any other devices that might have contained evidence to Kroll, a private security firm retained by Weinstein. She also agreed to surrender the passwords to her email accounts and other forms of digital communication that could have been used to spirit out copies. The Weinstein confidentiality agreement is perhaps the most usurious one I have seen in decades of practice. One attorney who represented Gutierrez later told me. A sworn statement, pre-signed by Gutierrez, was attached to the agreement, to be released in the event of any breach. It stated that the behavior Weinstein admitted to in the recording never happened. I looked up from the agreement and the reporter's notebook in which I'd been transcribing notes as quickly as I could. "Ombra, are all the copies of the tape destroyed?" Gutierrez folded her hands in her lap and looked at them. A moment later, I was walking fast out of the restaurant and toward the subway, dialing Rich McHugh. I told him the story. "It's real," I said, "and there's audio of him admitting to it." I texted Noah Oppenheim. "I'm now in touch with 5 women with HW allegations, FYI. I just met with a model who wore a wire for an NYPD investigation in 2015. She's going to play me the recordings. She wants to talk, but she took a payout with an NDA. She showed me the document. It's legit, signed by HW, $1 million. When he replied hours later, he asked only, "Who's your producer on this?" Then fell silent. Back at 30 Rockefeller Plaza, McHugh and I sat opposite Rich Greenberg in his office on the 4th floor. "It's quite the story," Greenberg said, leaning back in his mesh office chair. "I mean, it's huge," said McHugh. "He admits to a crime." Greenberg swiveled toward his monitor. "Let's see here," he said, typing Gutierrez's name into Google and switching over to the Images tab. He scrolled through a few pictures of Gutierrez sprawling seductively in lingerie and said, "Not bad." "We're close to a big piece of evidence here," I said, impatient. "She says she'll play the audio for me." "Well, let's see about that," Greenberg said. "And there's the contract," McHugh added. "That part's complicated," Greenberg said. "We can't be making her breach contract."
"We're not making her do anything," I replied. Later that afternoon, I called Chung, the NBC lawyer. "Theoretically, someone could say we induced her to violate her contract, but that tort is weird. There are a lot of conflicting interpretations of what's required to prove it. Some say you need to demonstrate the defendant had the sole purpose of violating the contract, which obviously isn't your objective," he said. "I'm sure Rich is just being careful." I had tried Jonathan a few times over the course of the afternoon, but only got through as I ducked out of Rockefeller Plaza at sunset.
"6 calls," he said. "I thought it was an emergency."
He was stepping out of a meeting.
5, I countered.
We'd met shortly after he left his job as a presidential speechwriter. In the years we'd been together, he'd drifted, creating a short-lived sitcom and tweeting a lot. A couple of months earlier, he and his friends had started a media company focused on podcasts on the West Coast. It had taken off faster than anyone predicted. His trips to New York had become shorter and less frequent.
"I'm checking," he was saying.
"Do it," I replied. I waited 30 seconds.
"Jonathan." "Sorry, forgot you were there."
This happened more than you'd think. These days, our relationship consisted almost exclusively of endless calls. Occasionally, he'd try to pause me, forgetting I wasn't a podcast. My phone pinged. I looked down to see a string of 20 or 30 Instagram message alerts. They came from an account with no profile photo. They read, over and over, "I'm watching you, I'm watching you, I'm watching you." I swiped them away. Strange messages were an occupational hazard of being on television. "The crazies love me," I said to Jonathan, and read him the messages. "He thinks he loves you, but wait until he experiences dating you."
"What does that mean?"
"It means I love you?"
"Does it?"
"Just working on my vows for the ceremony. On the moon, in our gravity boots." This was a running joke. Jonathan's mother wanted grandchildren and not in the age of lunar bases. This conversation again? I said, playing along. Just get someone at NBC to take a look at the threats. Take it seriously, please. After that first meeting with Gutierrez, I followed up again with the same contact in the district attorney's office. It's weird, the contact said. The recording, it's referenced in the case files, but I don't think we have it. This seemed improbable. The DA's office would, according to standard procedure, have retained any evidence, in case the investigation was ever reopened. I said, thank you, and chalked it up to an insufficiently thorough search. A week after our first conversation, I met with Gutierrez again, at a basement noodle place near Union Square. She'd arrived from a casting call, in full hair and makeup. It was like conducting an interview in a shampoo commercial. She talked about Berlusconi's corrupt media empire and how she'd marshaled the strength to help expose him. With each conversation we had, she sounded more like she was ready to do it again. Earlier in the day, she'd sent me a picture of an ancient MacBook and explained that she'd lost the charging cable. I found a cable of the right vintage and, as we talked, the laptop charged on a nearby chair. I kept glancing over at it nervously. Finally, I asked, as nonchalantly as possible, if she thought it had enough juice. The restaurant was noisy, so we left and walked around the corner to a Barnes & Noble. She opened the laptop again. Glancing from one side to the other, she navigated through a series of subfolders, past modeling photos and innocuous-looking Word documents.
"Before the order to give all my phone my computer," she said as she delved deeper into her hard drive, "I sent recording to myself, to all my emails."
She'd agreed to give Kroll the passwords to all those accounts and knew they'd find any she didn't disclose. But, in order to buy herself a brief window of opportunity, she'd told them she couldn't recall one password. Then, as Kroll wiped the other accounts, one by one, she'd logged into the one for which she was supposedly recovering the password, forwarded the audio to a temporary burner email, then cleared her sent mail. Finally, she downloaded the files to this old laptop, which she stuffed in the back of a closet.
"I was not sure it works," she said. "It was like..."
She made a gasping noise and held her breath as if bracing for the worst. But Kroll didn't come knocking, and the laptop collected dust, uncharged, for 2 years. On the screen in front of her, Gutierrez came to a folder labeled Mama. Inside were audio files titled Mama 1, Mama 2, and Mama 3, the recordings she'd had to frantically start each time her phone issued a push alert about its dwindling battery life during the police sting. She passed me a pair of headphones, and I listened. It was all there. The promises of career advancement, the list of other actresses he had helped, the encounter with the officer Weinstein thought was a TMZ photographer. In the recording, Gutierrez's panic was palpable.
"I'm telling you right now.
What do we have to do here?
Nothing. I'm going to take a shower. You sit there and have a drink. Water.
I don't drink. Can I stay on the bar?
No, you must come here now.
No.
Please.
No, I don't want to.
I'm not doing anything with you.
I know.
You're embarrassing me.
I'm sorry. I cannot. No, yesterday was a kind of aggressive for me.
I need
to know a person to
be
touched.
I won't do a thing, please. I swear I won't. Just sit with me. Don't embarrass me in the hotel. I'm here all the time.
I know, but I don't want to.
Please sit there. Please. Mm-hmm. 1 minute.
No, I
ask
can't.
You. Go to the bathroom.
Please, I don't want to do something I don't want
go to. Go to the bathroom. Come here. Listen to me.
I want to go downstairs.
I'm not going to do anything. You'll never see me again after this. Okay? That's it. If you embarrass me in this hotel,
I'm not embarrassing you. It's just that I don't feel comfortable.
I mean, don't have a fight with me.
It's not nice.
Please, I'm not going to do anything. I swear, my children. Please come in. On everything. I'm a famous guy.
I'm feeling very uncomfortable
right
now.
Please come in now. And 1 minute. And if you want to leave, when the guy comes with my jacket,
you can go. Why yesterday you touched my breast?
Oh, please, I'm sorry. Just come on. I'm used to that.
Are you used to that?
Yes, come in.
No, but I'm not used to that.
I won't do it again. Come on. Sit here for a minute, please.
No, I don't want to.
If you do this now, you will embarrass me. But no.
Bye.
They will call me again. Okay? I'm sorry. I promise you I won't do anything. with it.
I know, but yesterday was too much.
The guy's coming. I will never do another thing to you. 5 minutes. Don't ruin your friendship with me for 5 minutes.
I know, but it's kind of like, it's too much for me. I can't.
Please, you're making a big scene here.
No,
please.
But I
want to
leave.
Okay, bye. Thank you.
Ambra, I said, slipping off the headphones, we need to make this public. Weinstein had wheedled and menaced and bullied and didn't take no for an answer. But more than that, it was a smoking gun. It was inarguable. There he was, admitting not just to a crime, but to a pattern. I'm used to that. I produced a USB drive from my pocket and slid it toward her across the countertop. I can't tell you what to do, I said. The decision is yours.
I know that, she replied.
She closed her eyes, seeming to sway for a moment.
I will, she said, but not yet.
Chapter 11. Bloom. The second meeting with Gutierrez made me late for drinks with a former assistant to Phil Griffin, my old boss at MSNBC. This is the most important story I've ever been on, I texted her. If I'm late, it's because I have absolutely no choice. After journalism, drama and being late were my great passions. No worries, hope it's going well, she replied, tolerantly. I was still apologizing when I arrived at the little French bistro where we'd agreed to meet. When I asked how Griffin was, she said it was funny I should mention it, that he'd asked after me, too. Griffin was the one who took a chance on me and brought me inside NBC. He was a talented producer who'd worked his way up through roles at CNN and, later, The Today Show and Nightly News. At CNN, he'd focused on sports. He was passionate about baseball and gracious about my incomprehension during his impassioned monologues about it. He talked about a lifelong dream of working for the New York Mets, and you got the sense he was only mostly joking. At the helm of MSNBC, he'd overseen the cable channel's periods of greatest success and survived its brutal low points. Griffin was the son of a Macy's executive and grew up in wealthy suburbs outside New York City and Toledo. Trim and bald and excitable, he had the carefree bearing of a man who'd mostly gotten his way. In the 2 years since my show was canceled, our contact had been limited to cordial office run-ins. I wondered if the former assistant was just being polite with the comment about Griffin mentioning me, and why I'd be on his radar if he had. Harvey Weinstein had been calling Boys, his attorney, about Rose McGowan since shortly after she tweeted the previous fall. But it wasn't until that spring that Weinstein mentioned NBC. I've heard they're doing a story, Weinstein said. He wanted to know if Boys had heard anything. Boys said he hadn't. Within days, Weinstein was on the phone again, repeating the question. By the second call with Boys, Weinstein seemed unsatisfied with the lawyer's answers. I know people at NBC, Weinstein reminded Boys. I'm going to find out about it. Weinstein had been apprehensively calling his attorneys about news outlets pursuing troublesome stories for years. But there was something different this time. He began telling people around him that he was getting information directly from NBC. Soon, he was relating claims about exactly how much the network had and the name of the reporter who was working on the story. Over the following weeks, I kept meeting with Gutierrez at the Union Square Barnes & Noble. She told me she'd meet with me and Greenberg and NBC's legal department to play them the audio and show them the contract. But she was still grappling with whether to actually hand over the evidence. After one of the meetings, I hesitated again before calling my sister, Dylan. So you need my advice again, she said, a teasing note in her voice. I explained the situation, a source, a tape, a contract. Everyone I spoke with was a potential informant who might relay information back to Weinstein. If I ever fully assembled the story, I'd be laying out the reporting for him and seeking comment. But for now, I was vulnerable, and warnings from sources about Weinstein's tactics had put me on edge. Who do I turn to on this? I asked her. Who do I trust? She thought for a moment. You should call Lisa Bloom. Lisa Bloom was the kind of lawyer who also plays one on television, but she appeared to use the platform to defend not just her clients, but also the ideal of protecting survivors of sexual violence who confronted the rich and powerful. She had written and spoken repeatedly in defense of my sister when few others did.
You, your sister, and mother have comported yourself with grace and dignity through the storm, empowering sexual abuse survivors everywhere, she'd written to me once. The very least I could do was speak out about Dylan's obvious credibility.
Bloom had appeared often on my show, representing accusers of Bill O'Reilly and of Bill Cosby.
Rich and powerful people get a pass. I see this every day in my own practice, she said in one segment about Cosby. I represent many victims of wealthy and successful predators. The first thing they do is go on the attack against the victim, try to dredge up anything from her life that they can find to embarrass her.
She'd seen how
women are smeared, or they are threatened that they will be smeared.
When Bloom picked up, I offered to keep our conversation off the record. She waved this away.
Please, she said.
She had a warm voice with a slight rasp.
Most of the time I'll want to comment, you know that.
Thanks, I said, but I'd appreciate your confidence anyway.
Of course, she said.
I know we're not under attorney-client privilege, but as a fellow lawyer, I trust you. If I ask you about a sensitive story, do you feel comfortable promising not to mention it to anyone until it comes out?
Absolutely,
she said. I said I was working on a story involving heavy-duty non-disclosure agreements and asked her view of their enforceability. She said the agreements usually held up, that they often stipulated financially devastating liquidated damages as a penalty for breach, and contained arbitration clauses that allowed them to be enforced secretly rather than in court. Curiously, Gutierrez's otherwise draconian agreement had lacked such an arbitration clause. Some entities, like Fox News, had of late declined to enforce the non-disclosure agreements signed by former employees with sexual harassment complaints. Bloom said it all depended on who was doing the enforcing.
It would help if I knew who this was about, Ronan.
She said this very slowly. And you promise I have your word this will be kept in confidence?
You have my word, she said.
It's about Harvey Weinstein. I was standing in my apartment, looking out at a wall of warehouse-style windows. Through one, a sliver of a ballet studio was visible. A leotard-clad back strained in and out of frame. I'm going to go to him for comment if it progresses to that point, I continued. But in the meantime, it's important for these women that it not get back to his people. Another pause. Then Lisa Bloom said,
I understand completely.
Gutierrez and McGowan had both said they needed attorneys. As a reporter, I had to maintain distance from sources' legal cases. I'd told both that I couldn't give legal advice or directly recommend lawyers, but I could point them to publicly available information about experts in the field. I asked Bloom for advice on attorneys with experience in cases involving non-disclosure agreements. McGowan would later reach out to one of them. Harvey Weinstein's standard approach to getting people on the phone was to bark their names at the assistants stationed in the anteroom outside his office. Not long after the calls with boys about NBC, he shouted two new names.
Get me Andy Lack, now! He said, and Phil Griffin.
When Weinstein reached Lack, the studio head and the network head exchanged brief pleasantries. But Weinstein, sounding anxious, got to the point quickly.
Hey, he said, your boy Ronan is doing a story on me, about the 90s and stuff.
My name seemed to register only dimly. Lack suggested Weinstein try Griffin, my old boss at MSNBC. To this, Weinstein launched into an argument about his innocence and the folly of the story.
Andy, it was the 90s, you know? Did I go out with an assistant or two that I shouldn't have? Did I sleep with one or two of them? Sure.
Lack said nothing to this.
It was the 90s, Andy,
Weinstein repeated. This seemed, for Weinstein, an important point of exculpation. And then, with a note of menace,
we all did that.
There was a pause before Andy Lack said, Harvey, say no more. We'll look into it. It was evening when Bloom called again. I was headed home, emerging from a subway stop.
How's it going?
She asked.
I was thinking, you know, I actually know David Boies a little, and even Harvey a little.
You didn't mention this to anyone, did you? I asked Bloom.
Of course I didn't. I'm just, you know, I had this idea I could maybe help connect you to them.
Lisa, this is very sensitive and very early. I promise you, I will get in touch with him when the time comes. Just please, don't say anything yet. You gave your word.
I just think it's worth considering, she said.
I'll let you know if things develop further, I replied. I was passing by St. Paul the Apostle, the fortress-like Gothic Revival church near my apartment. I looked up, then hurried out of its shadow.
I'm here if you need anything, okay?
Bloom said.
Anything at all.
Chapter 12. Funny. That week, McHugh and I sat in Greenberg's office, updating him on the conversations with Gutierrez. I told him about her offer to meet with our legal department and show them the evidence. Let's get this scheduled before she gets cold feet, I said. Greenberg wouldn't commit to the meeting. He said we needed the audio in hand, not just played for us. I agreed, but said Gutierrez was getting closer to sharing it and argued that the meeting with NBC might help persuade her. Greenberg again raised his concern that looking at contracts might incur liability.
You need to be running all of this by legal, he said.
He kept fiddling with a pen in front of him on the desk. I was reminding him that I'd run every step of the reporting by legal when the phone on his desk rang. He looked at the caller ID, paused.
It's Harvey Weinstein, Greenberg said.
He called earlier today. McHugh and I looked at each other. This was news to us. Greenberg said Weinstein had pressed for details about the story. He'd led with flattery, saying he was a fan of mine, a fan of the network. Then he'd turned to saber-rattling.
He mentioned he's retained some lawyers, Greenberg said.
He flipped through some notes in front of him. David Boies? I asked.
He mentioned Boies, but there was someone else as well. Here it is, Charles Harder.
Harder was the pit bull attorney who, in an invasion of privacy case bankrolled by the billionaire Peter Thiel, had recently prevailed in shutting down the gossip news site Gawker. I told him we couldn't discuss specifics, of course, Greenberg continued. We do this by the book. Let him call all he wants. Our reporting was in limbo. Gutierrez was still deliberating about handing over the audio. Rosanna Arquette's agent had stopped returning my calls. The English actress confirmed the story her agent had told me, then got cold feet and fell silent. Ashley Judd, whose comments about an unnamed studio executive had featured echoes of McGowan's and Gutierrez's claims, a meeting moved from a hotel restaurant to a hotel room, a request that she watch him take a shower, hadn't responded to my inquiries. One afternoon that March, I found a quiet stretch of cubicles vacated for renovations and called Annabella Sciorra. In the preceding weeks, others had mentioned she might have a story. Sciorra, who was raised in Brooklyn by Italian parents, had made a name for herself in movies like The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, and later received an Emmy nomination for a guest role on The Sopranos. She had a reputation for playing steely, tough characters, but when she picked up the phone, her voice sounded small and tired.
It was so strange hearing from you,
she said of my Twitter inquiry that had prompted the call.
I wasn't sure what it was about, but I'm an MSNBC viewer, you know, so I was happy to talk.
I told her I was working on a story about allegations of sexual harassment against Harvey Weinstein, and that two people had suggested she might have something to say.
Oh, that, she said, managing a tinny laugh. It's weird. I've heard that before. Who told you that?
I told her I couldn't reveal other sources without their permission.
It could help a lot of people if you do know anything, I said, even if you can only talk anonymously.
On the other end of the call, Sciorra was in her living room in Brooklyn, staring out at the East River. She hesitated, then said,
No, nothing happened.
Another thin laugh.
I don't know, I guess I just wasn't his type.
I thanked her and told her to call me if she remembered anything.
I wish I could help, she replied. I'm sorry.
Early that April, I sat at my desk and looked at a text that had just come in.
Hey,
it read,
It's Matthew Hiltzik. Have a quick question for you.
Hiltzik was a prominent publicist. He was a reliable choice for news personalities and had, for years, handled Katie Couric's communications. When I'd despaired at the flood of tabloid items about me and my family several years earlier, I'd briefly retained his services at MSNBC's suggestion, and he'd been compassionate. Hiltzik was an equal opportunity spin doctor. He was closely entwined with both the Clinton and Trump families. Ivanka Trump was a client of his firm, and two of his underlings, Hope Hicks and Josh Rafel, had found roles in Trump's White House. Soon, Hiltzik was calling.
Hey, how are you doing?
He said, brightly. There was a hum of voices in the background, like he was stepping out of a party.
I'm at this event, he explained. Hillary's speaking.
Hiltzik never called without a reason. I stayed vague about how I was. Juggling a few shoots, I told him. Dealing with a book deadline. I'd been spending my nights furiously assembling a long gestating book about the declining role of diplomacy in America's foreign policy.
So it sounds like your other stories are on the back burner a little, Hiltzik was saying.
Like I said, Hillary's here, and Harvey's here, who I've worked with over the years.
I said nothing.
He just walked in, actually,
Hiltzik continued.
He said to me, who's this Ronan guy? He's asking questions about me? Is he investigating me?
Are you representing him? I asked.
Not exactly. We have a long relationship. He knows I know you. I said I'd do him a little favor. I told him, look, calm down, Harvey. Ronan is a good guy. I said you and I would have a little chat.
I investigate a lot of leads, and I really can't talk about any of them until they're ready to go.
Is this for NBC?
Hiltzik asked. I mean, I'm an investigative correspondent at NBC.
Is this about Rose McGowan?
He pressed.
Because he says he can clear that up.
Choosing my words carefully, I told him I always welcomed information. There was muffled shouting in the background.
He's so funny, Hiltzik said. He's saying all kinds of...
He paused for effect.
Funny things.
2 hours later, Hiltzik texted.
He is sort of hilarious. Gave your message. He asked me to call you back.
Then Hiltzik was on the phone again, saying of Weinstein,
he doesn't always have a normal reaction,
and
he's agitated, he's upset.
I'm sorry to hear that, I said.
At times, people can be aggressive and try to mess with him by suggesting there's even a story here. He says the same stories keep coming back, and the conclusion is always that it's not true, or not true to the degree people think.
He mentioned that The New Yorker and New York Magazine had pursued the story. One of the reporters had
just called everyone in Harvey's world. It freaked him out.
Weinstein had
gotten more sensitive about it.
What does sensitive mean? I asked.
He's older now. He's mellowed a bit. I don't think he's going to be taking action immediately, but...
Taking action? I said.
Well, he's not dumb. He's going to do something. Look, you have your book to finish, right? So this is on the back burner for you,
he said. I glanced at the notes I'd been taking throughout the call. My eyebrows went up when I saw it. Hiltzik had let slip a small but useful lead. Applause sounded on Hiltzik's end of the line. What event are you at? I asked. Hiltzik explained that Hillary Clinton had finished a green room conversation with Weinstein, her old friend and fundraiser, then stepped on stage to give a speech at Women in the World. I texted Greenberg about Hiltzik immediately. The next day, Greenberg called. He led with strained small talk about my foreign policy book that suggested he was ramping up to something. Then he said,
by the way, I met with Noah today and, you know, we were talking about 10 different things. It wasn't that we met about this topic, but he asked about your favorite story.
He chuckled.
I told him there's smoke, but I don't know that there's fire. We don't really have a smoking gun. I said, Noah, if you ask me right now, you know, I don't think we have it.
I reminded him that I'd heard audio of Weinstein admitting to an assault and seen his signature on a $1 million non-disclosure agreement. I pressed on whether we could schedule that meeting between Gutierrez and our lawyers.
It's not in the news. I don't think there's any rush here, Greenberg said. I think where we stand now is we give it a rest.
What does give it a rest mean? I asked.
You know, just keep it on the back burner,
Greenberg said.
That phrase again, I thought. Ronan, you have so many promising things going on. You've got a lot of stories in progress. The series is doing well. You know, you don't have to necessarily focus on this.
A few minutes later, I was on the phone with McHugh. He was as puzzled as I was. This feels like somebody called them, he said. You hear from Hiltzik and Harvey and then this? It doesn't feel like a coincidence. I'm sure they got calls and I'm sure they're standing up to them. Noah will back this. Well, our immediate boss doesn't want you reporting. You're going to have to decide if you go along with that.
We'll bring them more evidence. They'll come around, I said.
But when McHugh told Greenberg he was setting aside an afternoon to make calls on the Weinstein story, Greenberg said, simply,
I think that can wait.
The situation was creating a catch-22. We needed more evidence, but continuing to gather it openly was, suddenly, a liability.
What happens when we need to shoot more interviews?
McHugh asked.
We're in fantastic shape here,
Alan Berger of Creative Artists Agency, CAA, was saying. The San Andreas Fault could split open and Los Angeles could slip right into the Pacific, and agents would still be running around reassuring clients how fantastic everything was.
Your nightly story about the prisons,
Berger continued. He had a warm, avuncular voice with an accent that knew its way around the Long Island Expressway. He was regarded in the business as a steady dealmaker.
You know your contract's up this fall.
I know, I said. I was in my apartment. In the ballet studio across the street, someone was buffing the floor. As the Weinstein story expanded, it crowded out other reporting and career considerations. I'd missed so many deadlines on my foreign policy book that my publisher had finally given up and canceled it that very week.
They love you there, Berger said of NBC. Noah loves you. Everyone sees a bigger role for you.
Well, I'm working on some stories that are making things a little
what, Ronan?
I can't talk about it, Alan. Just let me know if anything seems weird.
Ronan, you're killing me, Berger said, laughing.
Just keep doing what you're doing, and don't piss anyone off.
Chapter 13. Dick. I flipped through my notes from the call with Hiltzik and looked at his comment about New York and the New Yorker magazines. At New York, Carr, with his suspicions of surveillance and intimidation, had chased the story, but that was in the early 2000s. Something in Hiltzik's observation about Weinstein's sensitivity suggested someone else had tried more recently. I sent another message to Jennifer Senior, the writer who'd worked with Carr. Can you find out if anyone else at New York was working on the story we discussed, potentially more recently than David? I asked. I keep hearing that this might have been the case. You're right, she wrote back. Just looked at my email. But I feel uncomfortable in this case saying who.
The attempt at the story, it seemed, had ended poorly. I asked her to pass on a message to the mystery writer. At the New Yorker, Ken Auletta, a writer known for his thorough appraisals of business and media executives, had profiled Weinstein in 2002. Entitled Beauty and the Beast, the piece made no explicit mention of sexual predation, but dwelled on Weinstein's brutality. He was, Auletta wrote, spectacularly coarse, even threatening. And there was a curious, overheated passage that hinted that there was more to the story. Auletta noted that Weinstein's business partners feel raped, a word often invoked by those dealing with him. I sent a message to an acquaintance who worked at the New Yorker and asked for Auletta's email address. Auletta was 75. He grew up on Coney Island, raised by a Jewish mother and an Italian father. There was something elegant and old world about his carriage and speech. And he was a careful, experienced reporter. Of course, there was more to it than we were able to print, he told me when I called him from an empty office near the investigative newsroom. Back in 2002, Auletta had pursued the claims that Weinstein was preying on women, and even asked about the allegations in an on-the-record interview. The two had been sitting in Weinstein's Tribeca offices. Weinstein stood up, face red, and shouted at Auletta. Are you trying to get my fucking wife to divorce me? Auletta stood, too, fully prepared to beat the shit out of him. But then Weinstein crumpled, sitting back down and beginning to sob. He basically said to me, look, I don't always behave well, but I love my wife. Weinstein hadn't denied the allegations. Auletta hadn't been able to secure an on-the-record claim like McGowan's or a piece of hard evidence like Gutierrez's tape and contract. But he had spoken to Zelda Perkins, an employee of Miramax in London who, alongside a colleague named Rowena Chu, was involved in a joint sexual harassment settlement with Weinstein. Though she was too frightened to go on the record, Auletta had been able to use Perkins's account as leverage, compelling Weinstein to concede there had been some kind of settlement with her and Chu in London. Weinstein even presented to the New Yorker the voided check used in the transaction to establish that it had been underwritten not by Miramax's parent company, Disney, but with private money from an account belonging to Weinstein's brother, Bob. But the checks had been shown to him off the record. When the brothers, along with David Boies, met with Auletta and New Yorker editor David Remnick, Weinstein had provided none of the further information they'd hoped might render the claims publishable. He'd evinced only furious denials and a barely checked temper. Years later, Auletta's frustration was still palpable. He was like a homicide detective kept awake at night by the case that got away. I had a fixation, he told me. By the end of his reporting, he said, I came to believe that he's a predator, a serial rapist, and to see exposing him as a public service. He had tried reviving the story twice over the years, most recently after the Gutierrez incident, but he'd gotten no traction. If you have any chance of succeeding where I failed, he told me, keep at it. Rose McGowan had stayed in touch, urging us to come shoot more with her. She mentioned in our conversations that she was finding more support. Lacey Lynch, the literary agent who had passed along the inquiry from Seth Friedman, the empathetic former Guardian writer, was also forwarding other expressions of solidarity. The day I spoke to Auletta, one such email arrived from Rubin Capital Partners, a London-based wealth management firm seeking to enlist McGowan in a charitable project called Women in Focus. The firm was planning a gala dinner at the end of the year and hoped McGowan would give a keynote speech.
"We have taken a keen interest in the work Ms. Rose McGowan does for the advocacy of women's rights, and we believe that the ideals she strives towards align closely with those upheld by our new initiative."
"I think it sounds good," Lynch wrote to McGowan. "We'd love to set up a call to learn more." The email from Rubin Capital Partners was signed by Diana Phillip, Deputy Head of Sustainable and Responsible Investments. The following morning, an email that I obtained many months later appeared in Harvey Weinstein's private Gmail account. "RF Info," the subject line read, "legally privileged. Harvey," the email read, "here's a rough overview of the info I've compiled so far on Ronan Farrow." Several dozen exhibits were attached. In a section of the email titled, "Persons of Interest That Farrow Is Following," was a list of some accusers I'd found and some I hadn't. The email noted that McHugh and I had followed, on social media, a cluster of McGowan's associates around the date of our interview, out of the blue, and speculated that I'd gotten her to talk. It observed that I was a fan of Lisa Bloom, appearing to assess her level of access to me, and it described my attempts to get in touch with Judd, Shiora, and Arquette. The email analyzed the likelihood that each of them would talk. It flagged any public statements the women had made about sexual violence as a warning sign. A section titled "Farrow Employment" contained an exhaustive list of coworkers who might provide access or information. There were obvious on-air investigative correspondents with whom I'd worked, like Cynthia McFadden and Stephanie Gosk. But the list also included coworkers who wouldn't be publicly identifiable, like an NBC intern whose desk was adjacent to mine. A biographical section appeared to search for pressure points. It noted what it described as family drama stirred by his sister Dylan Farrow in her accusations of rape against their father Woody Allen. The topic I'd spent years trying to outrun was coming back to haunt me. The email was sent by Sarah Ness, a private investigator at a firm called PS Ops. Jack Palladino and Sandra Sutherland, a husband and wife team, operated the firm. A rare profile of the two in People magazine compared them to Nick and Nora Charles, the detective couple from The Thin Man, minus the glamour. During the 1992 presidential campaign, Bill Clinton hired Palladino to discredit stories about women claiming to have had relationships with the Arkansas governor, per the Washington Post. By the late 90s, Palladino had earned the nickname the President's Dick. He said he never broke the law. But, he proudly noted, "I go right to the boundaries of the envelope." "Jack is overseas, but I have kept him up to speed on this investigation and will confer with him this week on the issues/potential strategies you and I discussed yesterday," Ness wrote to Weinstein that day in April. She promised that a fuller and more formal dossier was forthcoming. The message made two things clear: that the research was meant to complement a larger effort involving players other than Palladino's firm, and that the dossier was just an opening salvo. Rich McHugh and I kept raising the idea of doing further reporting on the Weinstein story, and Greenberg kept telling us to focus on other things. Greenberg was our boss. The conversations were becoming awkward. But after the call with Oletta, it was becoming clear that we had secured more hard evidence than anyone had before about a story that had stayed buried for decades. "What do we do?" I asked McHugh. We were huddled on the margins of the newsroom. "I don't know," he replied. "I think if you go to Greenberg, he told you to put the story on the back burner." "He didn't order us to stop," I said wearily. "He said we could meet again about it." "Okay," McHugh said, skeptical. "But maybe it's strategic to be armed with as much as possible before that meeting," I conceded. "That's my inclination," he said. "Let's just get on with it." We agreed to shore up the reporting. We'd return with a bulletproof body of evidence and ask for forgiveness, not permission. Calls could be done quietly, but we debated how to keep our on-camera interviews going without running afoul of Greenberg. The next day, McHugh motioned me over to his computer. "We have a green light on shooting for, what, 3-4 stories?" We were working on several about addiction and the one about Dow Chemical and Shell seeding California farmlands with toxic waste. "You think you can schedule these Weinstein interviews around those shoots?" he asked. "Well, yeah, but they'd be marked as Weinstein interviews anyway," I said. "Not necessarily," he said. "We add interviews that come up suddenly into our existing travel all the time, and we can label them anything we want." There were limits on how much we could hide the work. The subject of any new interviews would still be revealed on detailed expense reports, but we could avoid calling attention to the matter with leadership. On his monitor, McHugh navigated to a networked drive on an NBC server. He scrolled through a list of directories containing our stories. Then he took the Weinstein files out of a folder titled Media Mogul and dropped them into a different one. I looked at the screen and laughed. The folder he'd chosen, named after the California waste story, was labeled Poison Valley. Part 2. White Whale. Chapter 14. Rookie. The men sat at Harvey Weinstein's usual table near the kitchen in the back of the Tribeca Grill. It was April 24th. Weinstein was there, and Dylan Howard of the National Enquirer, and an operative from Black Cube. The operative looked young, with dark hair and a heavy accent. Lanny Davis walked in and surveyed the room. Davis was by then in his early 70s, a thin man with graying hair and bags under his eyes. He was raised in Jersey City, his father a dentist, his mother a manager in the dental office. At Yale Law School, Davis had become friends with Hillary Rodham and later Bill Clinton. After a failed run for Congress and a few years of legal practice, he'd spun this friendship into a professional role as their most ardent defender in times of scandal and political peril. Then, Davis cashed in, taking on jobs that earned him $1 million to lobby his way around Equatorial Guinea's human rights abuses, or $100,000 a month to downplay a patently rigged election in Ivory Coast. If a passenger disappeared and left a smear of blood on the deck of your cruise ship, or the president criticized your football team's racist name, Davis was there. Trying to get a hold of Davis later on, I asked Jonathan, "Who would have Lanny Davis's number?" He replied, "I don't know, Paul Pot?" Weinstein, who had met Davis at an event honoring Hillary Clinton and knew of the crisis manager's familiarity with the sexual misconduct allegations against Bill Clinton, had called that spring to enlist him. At the Tribeca Grill that morning, Davis said they couldn't talk in front of the Black Cube operative if Weinstein wanted to maintain attorney-client privilege.
"I can't talk in front of people who aren't attorneys," Davis said. "If I'm subpoenaed, I have to tell if someone else is in the room."
Weinstein seemed annoyed by this.
"Oh, yes, you can," he said. "You can maintain privilege if he works for me."
This was an oversimplification of the law, but Weinstein was insistent, and Davis relented. Weinstein ranted. McGowan, he said, was crazy, a liar. He wanted to discredit all the women making what he described as false claims about him.
"My advice is don't do that," Davis told Weinstein, "even if you think you're right."
Weinstein began to bellow.
"Why? Why? Why? Why?"
"Because it looks awful," Davis said.
Dylan Howard grinned, which he did a lot. The man from Black Cube did not. A few hours after the meeting at the Tribeca Grill, Dr. Avi Janus, Black Cube's director and CFO, sent an email to Weinstein's attorneys at Boies Schiller Flexner, calling the meeting productive. He wrote that Weinstein had agreed to a 10-week extension of Black Cube's operation on his behalf. An invoice was attached. The email continued,
"We are committed as ever to bring you with game-changing intelligence in this case and to successfully reach all of our main objectives."
I scoured Aletta's old profile of Weinstein for sources that might lead me to the two settlements in London, calling one after another. Donna Gelati, the Shakespeare in Love producer, had discouraged me when we first spoke, but when I called her again, she revealed more.
"There are documents out there," she said, "where he's never admitting guilt, but large sums of money are paid. You need those documents, but the victims are never allowed to keep them."
I asked her if she meant, for example, documents related to two women with complaints in London.
"If you find them," she said, "maybe I can talk. Until then, I'm afraid I can't."
She did, however, give me the names of several other former employees who had been in the London offices in the same era and might help. I thanked her. She was not optimistic.
"Nothing's stopping Harvey," she told me. "He will squash this story."
Celebrities hurried out of SUVs, bowed their heads into heavy rain, and filed into Time Magazine's annual gala dinner celebrating its 100 Most Influential People list. I was not on the list. I was, however, soaked. "I'm an aquarium," I said, walking into the Time Warner Center. "I'm the plot of Chinatown." My mother shrugged.
"Wet's always in. It's classic."
The event was heavy on television news figures. I blundered through awkward conversations with them. Megyn Kelly, Tony and sequined and charismatic in a way that made you feel you were the only person in the room, mentioned her forthcoming NBC show. I congratulated her, then said I was sorry about the Twitter thing. I quickly realized my gaffe. Kelly had departed Fox News tailed by supercut videos of her saying things that were, depending on whom you asked, either clumsy or malicious about people of color. The Twitter thing was that I'd called a comment of hers racist. A tendon stood out on Kelly's neck.
"I made a lot of mistakes when I was at your point in my career, too," she said, smiling tightly. "You're kind of a rookie reporter."
I stalked off, moistly, to find a bathroom or a drink or anything but more conversation, and instead found Andy Lack. As we shook hands, he looked at me like he was processing something. Lack had tufts of graying hair and an affable but appraising smile. At almost 70, he had enjoyed an eclectic career, with a through line of creative showmanship. Like Oppenheim, he'd dreamed of Hollywood. He'd studied acting at Boston University, and after graduating, landed roles in a Broadway production of Inquest, a play about Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, and in a few commercials.
"He was charming, charismatic," one person close to Lack later told me. "His background in theater makes him a unique creative mind."
At CBS News in the 80s, his signature achievement was West 57th, an edgy and stylish spin on the classic news magazine format. During his first stint as an NBC News executive in the 90s, he'd been credited with a turnaround in a time of disarray and declining ratings. Positions at Sony Music and Bloomberg Television had followed. In 2015, NBC had brought him back to right the ship again. Lack was still giving me that searching look.
"Ronan," I said quickly.
"Yes," he said, finally, as if dredging something heavy up from the bottom of a deep body of water. "Yes, of course." He said Oppenheim talked a lot about me. I thanked him for getting behind investigative stories. I reached for a personal connection. My brother had recently purchased Lack's home in Bronxville, New York. "Apparently you left behind a giant safe they still haven't drilled open," I said. Lack laughed. "That's true, there is an old safe." He said the safe had preceded him, and he hadn't opened it either. He shrugged. "Sometimes it's better to leave things be." The room began to thin, guests filtering into an adjacent amphitheater for dinner. I found my mother, headed in the same direction. Oppenheim approached us.
"That's Noah," I whispered to my mother. "Tell him you liked Jackie." "But I didn't like Jackie," she said.
I shot her a withering look. They said their hellos, and then Oppenheim pulled me aside. "So, Harvey's here," he said. "He's sitting with me at dinner." I stared at him. I'd been keeping him apprised of every element of the reporting. "You do know I've heard a recording of him admitting to a sexual assault," I said. Oppenheim raised both hands in a defensive gesture. "I believe you," he said.
"It's not about believing," I trailed off.
"Don't mention anything, obviously."
"Of course," he said.
A moment later, I watched as Oppenheim stood at the entrance to the amphitheater, talking to a hulking figure in a baggy black tuxedo. Harvey Weinstein was recovering from knee surgery, leaning on a cane. The first week of May, Black Cube called Weinstein with a promising update.
"We informed the client that following our intense efforts, we scheduled a meeting in LA next week, which we believe will lead to the disclosure of high-quality intelligence and hard evidence for the purposes of our work."
Janus, the Black Cube director, wrote to Weinstein's lawyers at Boies Schiller. This new phase of the project would require a new cash injection as well. A few days later, on May 12th, Christopher Boies, David Boies' son and a partner at his firm, oversaw the wiring of another $50,000 to Black Cube. In the preceding days, Lynch, the agent advising Rose McGowan, had brokered the proposed introduction between McGowan and Diana Phillip of Rubin Capital Partners, who had reached out to enlist McGowan in her Women in Focus campaign.
"Rose, it's a great pleasure to connect with you," Phillip wrote.
"It is my great pleasure to connect with you as well," McGowan replied.
The day Boies Schiller's latest payment appeared in Black Cube's account, Philip and McGowan finally met face-to-face at the Belvedere, the airy, pastel-colored Mediterranean restaurant at the Peninsula Hotel in Beverly Hills. Philip had high cheekbones, a prominent nose, and dirty blonde hair. She had an elegant accent McGowan couldn't place. McGowan was skeptical of strangers, but Philip seemed to know everything about her, and more than that, to understand her. The actress let her guard down just a little. Chapter 15. Static. Jennifer Senior made good on her promise and introduced me to Ben Wallace, the New York Magazine writer behind that publication's most recent attempt at the Weinstein story. One afternoon that May, I called him as I left Rockefeller Plaza. Wallace told me how frustrating the assignment had been. Anything he learned seemed immediately, inexplicably, to get back to Weinstein. "Everyone was a double agent," Wallace told me. This seemed to be especially true of several sources who had offered to help. He'd suspected that Anna, the European woman who'd told him she had a story about Weinstein, was hiding something. Some of her questions had felt strange. Anna wanted to know not just how many other sources he was working with, but who they were. The information she seemed bent on extracting was out of proportion to what she was giving. At times, she appeared to press him to make statements that betrayed bias. At the hotel bar, when she eventually broke down and recounted her story about Weinstein, it was mild and generalized. She said she and Weinstein had an affair that ended poorly. She wanted revenge. The performance had a soap operatic quality. As she dangled her wrist in front of him, Wallace had a prickly suspicion that she might be secretly recording. He told Anna that he sympathized, but considered consensual affairs to be Weinstein's own business. Then he left the hotel bar and stopped taking her calls. Wallace had the same feeling that something was off when he received the email from Seth Friedman, the former writer for The Guardian who wanted to help. Friedman wrote that he was working with a group of international journalists on a large story about the film industry, giving a sense of the present-day culture of Hollywood and other film capitals. He claimed to have come across a great deal of information which we can't include in our pieces, which might be of use to you. I would be very happy to share it with you if you're interested. But after several conversations with Friedman, Wallace still hadn't gotten any meaningful information out of him. He was pumping me for what I had heard and learned, Wallace recalled. Suspicious, he cut ties there, too. Weinstein's associates started calling New York Magazine, sometimes threatening to deliver unspecified personal information about Wallace. Weinstein demanded a meeting between his legal team, investigators from Kroll, and the magazine. The intention, Wallace assumed, was to come in with dossiers slagging various women and me. The magazine declined the meeting. In January of 2017, after 3 months of reporting, Wallace and his editor, Adam Moss, decided to stand down. At a certain point, Wallace told me, the magazine just couldn't afford to spend indefinite time. The experience had clearly put him on edge. As Weinstein and his team began calling New York with an uncanny knowledge of his leads, Wallace purchased a paper shredder and destroyed his notes. I was more paranoid than ever before, he told me. There was much more static and distraction than I've encountered on any other story. Wallace hadn't gotten any sources on the record or discovered dispositive documents or recordings, but he had assembled a list of women with allegations. He rattled off a few names I had heard myself, including that of Asia Argento, the Italian actress whom several former Weinstein colleagues had suggested I find. There were also a few sources he had gotten to speak on background, telling their full stories, but with their identities obscured, including a former assistant who had been harassed by Weinstein and complained to HR at his company. Please, I said, just ask her if she'd talk. In the glass that separated the investigative bullpen and the fourth floor studio, I sometimes caught glimpses of my reflection. That spring, I'd filled out a little and gotten some color from all the shooting in Los Angeles. There was a feeling of momentum around McHugh and me and our little investigative series. We were receiving the kind of television journalism awards you never hear of in the outside world, and enthusiastic appraisals in outlets that cover media. The head of communications at NBC News, Mark Kornblau, had also worked at the State Department during my time there. Over coffee as I transitioned from my role at MSNBC to the network, and in our encounters since, he'd been supportive. Kornblau and his team nurtured the positive coverage, giving quotes or allowing me to do so. The mood seemed to extend to others. An NBC veteran named David Corvo stopped me in the hall. Corvo was the executive producer of Dateline. A small, animated man with a bushy beard, he'd been working at NBC since the mid-90s. He was close with Lack. "Let's get together," Corvo said. "You're doing exactly the kind of stories we want." It was early evening when Ambra Gutierrez and I sat down at a quiet restaurant in the theater district called Brazil Brazil. I'd spent the previous month trying to find another way to obtain the recording. Police sources told me they believed Gutierrez. They were convinced they'd had the evidence they needed to charge Weinstein, despite the DA's decision not to. But none of the conversations had gotten me any closer to the recording. With Gutierrez, I had tried on for size every possible approach that might allow her to pass me her copy. What if she left and went to the bathroom, and I just happened to have access to her computer? No, she said. She stood to lose too much. She was worried about her brother.
"I have to get him here from Philippines," she said.
Gutierrez was sounding increasingly skittish. It was Jonathan who, the night before, had suggested another feint toward plausible deniability. "What if you record her recording? Literally hold a microphone to a speaker. You make something new. She never transfers anything." "What does that do?" "It just feels like a step removed. No files ever change hands." "Forget it, it's dumb." "Wait, it might be good." "It's so good," I laughed. Besides, I didn't have a better idea. In the restaurant with Gutierrez, I leaned in and made the last-ditch proposal. "There's no digital paper trail, there's no flash drive to uncover, and I have a file that didn't come from your hard drive." She drew a deep breath. I sat back, watching her, thinking there was no way on earth this would work.
"Maybe," she said. She pulled the old MacBook from her bag. "Okay, maybe it's worth a try."
I felt a wash of adrenaline. We both knew the cover would be thin. She was taking a risk. I thanked her. She nodded and opened the laptop, and I pulled out my phone.
"Wait," she said. "We have problem."
The old MacBook, it came to pass, had no working speakers. I leaned in again, speaking fast. "Ambra, if I go get us an external speaker, will you be here when I get back?" She glanced around, gave me an uncertain look. "Just give me 20 minutes, I said. I sprinted from the restaurant and into the crush of West 46th Street. Where to go? There would probably be a place with electronics among the small tourist shops that sell I Love New York hats on Broadway, but I didn't know exactly where to look. I took out my phone, found the nearest big box electronics store. It was farther, but a surer thing. I shoved through the pre-theater crowd, got to the corner, waved a hand frantically at oncoming cabs. By the time I limped into the store, I was drenched in sweat. I hurried down an escalator and all but screeched to a halt in front of a shelf of what looked like several thousand speakers. "Hi, can I help you?" a clerk asked. "I need a speaker," I gasped. "Well, sir, we've got you covered," he said brightly. "We've got your Bluetooth, your Wi-Fi, your USB. You looking for something Alexa-activated? This one's got a little LED light show." I stared at him crazily. 15 minutes later, I was running back into the restaurant, four different overpriced speakers jangling against one another. Gutierrez was still there. She shot me a nervous smile. In a garden behind the restaurant, I unboxed one of the speakers. The Bluetooth on the old Mac, mercifully, worked. We agreed that she would play the middle of the three files. Anything that replicated the breaks between sections would betray that it had derived from her phone copy rather than the presumably unbroken one taken from her police wire. She drew a deep breath and said,
"I hope the other girls get justice."
We huddled over the laptop. She hit play, and I captured 2 minutes of a terrified woman struggling to get away from a hotel suite and a brutal man not taking no for an answer. "Just come on in," I heard him say again. "I'm used to that." I needed advice. The next day, I knocked on Tom Brokaw's office door on the fifth floor of 30 Rock. In my earliest months at NBC, Brokaw had approached me as we stood online for coffee at a shop in the building's basement concourse. He'd seen my show, he said. He thought I was trying to do something smarter than usual for the format. "Thank you, sir," I'd said. "It means a lot coming from you." "Tom, please," he'd responded. "We're not headmaster and head boy here." He accepted my invitations to appear on air with me more often than he had to, and his commentary was always eloquent and full of historical insight. Brokaw was in his late 70s then. A few years earlier, he'd been diagnosed with blood cancer. That day in May, He pottered around his office, showing me pictures of Meredith, his wife of more than 50 years, and told a few stories about old Hollywood. "So, what can I do for you?" he said, finally. I told him I was working on a sensitive story, and that I was concerned that it wasn't being elevated in the way it needed to be. I mentioned Greenberg's back burner comments. "I know Noah will get behind it," I said. "I'm just worried about interference before it gets there." "Well, you have to stick to your guns, Ronan," he said. "If you back down, you'll fuck your credibility." I laughed. Brokaw said he thought it was a good idea to shore up all the additional leads I could before taking it back to the powers that be. He said he'd call Andy Lack and Noah Oppenheim when I did so. "Who's it about, by the way?" he said, finally. I hesitated for a moment, then told him it was Weinstein. The warmth drained out of the room. "I see," he said. "Well, I have to disclose, Ronan, that Harvey Weinstein is a friend." The two had connected when Brokaw was soliciting advice on a documentary about veterans, he said. Weinstein had been good to him.
Shit, I thought. Is anyone not friends with this guy?
"I assume I can still count on your confidence," I said to Brokaw. "You can," he said. He showed me out of the office, seeming troubled. As I stepped out, my phone rang. It was Lisa Bloom.
"Hey,"
she said brightly, then proceeded to make small talk about a model she was representing who had been a victim of revenge porn.
"We should get together and talk," Bloom said. "I could get you an interview with her."
"Sure," I said, distracted.
"By the way, are you still working on that story about NDAs?"
Bloom had said she was acquainted with Weinstein and his team, and sure, she was attentive to her brand and didn't hate a press conference, but she had moral fiber I felt I could trust. Besides, she was a lawyer. Respecting confidences was the bedrock of our profession. "I am," I said after a beat.
"So it's going forward," she said.
I'm working on it."
"Have you seen any of the non-disclosure agreements?"
I paused again. "I'm aware of some specific agreements, yes."
"How many women are you talking to? Can you tell me who they are?" she asked. "I may be able to help get you information if you can share who you're talking to."
"I can't talk about specific sources," I said, "but there's a group and it's growing, and if you have any advice on what I should be doing to insulate them from liability, I welcome it."
"Absolutely," she said.
When I checked my phone after we hung up, I saw I'd missed another volley of Instagram messages from the same mysterious handle. This time, the final message was a photograph of a pistol. One of the messages read, "Sometimes you have to hurt the things you love." I took a handful of screenshots and made a note to myself to find out whom to talk to at NBC about security. Chapter 16. FOH. The next time my phone chimed, it was happier news. Ben Wallace, from New York Magazine, was following up. The former assistant he hadn't quite managed to get on the record would talk to me. The following week, in the closing days of May, I walked into the lobby of a Beverly Hills hotel. I hadn't looked up what the source looked like, but I recognized her quickly. She was slender and blonde and striking. She cracked a nervous grin.
"Hey," she said, "I'm Emily."
Emily Nestor was in her late 20s and held law and business degrees from Pepperdine. She was working at a tech startup, but seemed to be searching for something more purposeful. She talked about wanting to work in education, maybe something with underprivileged kids. A few years earlier, she'd harbored ambitions in the film business, hoping to produce and perhaps someday run a studio. But an experience she'd had as a temporary assistant had shaken her belief in the business. The casual, practiced nature of the harassment had made her worry it was a pattern, and the response when she reported it had left her disillusioned. I laid out for her what we had. McGowan and Gutierrez named in the story, and the audio, and the growing number of executives on camera. I was transparent about how precarious it all was, too. Nestor still looked scared as she told me she'd think about it. She was frightened of retaliation. But I could tell that she was too fierce in her convictions to shy away. A few days later, she was in. She'd go on camera, though she wanted to be unnamed and in shadow to start out, then see how she felt about going further. And she had evidence, messages from Irwin Ryder, a senior executive who had worked for Weinstein for almost 3 decades, acknowledging the incident and alluding to its being part of a pattern of predation inside the company. A third woman and more hard evidence. It felt like the threshold we'd been waiting for. "Once we bring him this," I told McHugh, "Noah will make sure it gets on air. He'll have to." Back home in New York, at a gala dinner at the Museum of the Moving Image, New York media elites assembled to honor Lester Holt and Roy Price, the head of Amazon Studios. Jeffrey Tambor, the actor, who was at the time appearing in Amazon's Transparent, toasted Price. Noah Oppenheim did the honors for Holt, praising his unflinching coverage of tough stories. Then he returned to his seat at NBC's table alongside David Corvo, the Dateline producer. Nearby, at Amazon's table, Harvey Weinstein applauded. Not long after, Nestor, McHugh, and I sat in a hotel room overlooking a glittering marina in Santa Monica. We were still tiptoeing around our shoots on the story, making the case bulletproof before we triggered a conversation with our bosses. We had set the date for Nestor's interview around the margins of a trip to California's Central Valley for the pollutants story. As we backlit her and her face deepened into shadow, Nestor said she anticipated a personal and vengeful response from Weinstein when he saw the story. In December 2014, when she was 25, Nestor had worked as a temporary front desk assistant at the Weinstein Company in Los Angeles. She was overqualified, but took the job on a lark to get a first-hand view of the entertainment industry. On her first day, Nestor said, two employees told her that she was Weinstein's type, physically. When Weinstein arrived at the office, he made comments about her appearance, referring to her as the pretty girl. He asked how old she was, and then sent his assistants out of the room and made her write down her telephone number. Weinstein told her to meet him for drinks that night. Nestor invented an excuse. When he insisted, she suggested an early morning coffee the next day, assuming that he wouldn't accept. He told her to meet him at the Peninsula Hotel, one of his favorite haunts. Friends in the entertainment industry and employees in the company had by then warned her about Weinstein's reputation. "I dressed very frumpy," she recalled. At the meeting, Weinstein offered her career help, then began to boast about his sexual liaisons with other women, including famous actresses. He said, "You know, we could have a lot of fun," Nestor recalled. "I could put you in my London office, and you could work there, and you could be my girlfriend." She declined. He asked to hold her hand. She said no. She recalled Weinstein remarking, "Oh, the girls always say no, you know, no, no, and then they have a beer or two, and then they're throwing themselves at me." In a tone that Nestor described as very weirdly proud, Weinstein added that he'd never had to do anything like Bill Cosby. She assumed that meant he'd never drugged a woman. Textbook sexual harassment was how Nestor described Weinstein's behavior. She recalled refusing his advances at least a dozen times. "No" did not mean no to him, she said. Throughout the meeting, Weinstein interrupted their conversation to yell into his cell phone, screaming at, of all people, Today Show management, enraged that they'd canceled a segment with Amy Adams, a star in the Weinstein movie Big Eyes, when she refused to answer questions about a recent hack targeting Sony executives. Afterward, Weinstein told Nestor to keep an eye on the news cycle, which he promised would be spun in his favor and against NBC. Later in the day, items critical of NBC's role in the spat surfaced as promised. Weinstein stopped by Nestor's desk later that day to make sure that she'd seen them. Nestor found the ferocity with which Weinstein moved to intimidate a news organization unsettling. By that point, she recalled, "I was very afraid of him, and I knew how well connected he was, and how if I pissed him off, then I could never have a career in that industry." Still, she told a friend about the incident, and he alerted the company's Office of Human Resources. Nestor had a conversation with company officials about the matter, but didn't pursue it further after they told her that Weinstein would be informed of anything she told them. Later, employee after employee would tell me the human resources office at the company was a sham, a place where complaints went to die. Irwin Ryder, Weinstein Company's executive vice president of accounting and financial reporting, had reached out to Nestor via LinkedIn. "We view this very seriously, and I personally am very sorry your first day was like this," Ryder wrote. "Also, if there are further unwanted advances, please let us know." In late 2016, just before the presidential election, he'd reached out again, writing, "All this Trump stuff made me think of you." He described Nestor's experience as part of Weinstein's serial misconduct. "I've fought him about mistreatment of women 3 weeks before the incident with you. I even wrote him an email that got me labeled by him as sex police," he wrote. "The fight I had with him about you was epic. I told him if you were my daughter, he would not have made out so well." Nestor gave me the messages and, eventually, permission to air them. Nestor left after completing her temporary placement, feeling traumatized. "I actually decided not to go into entertainment because of this incident," she told me. Behind her, the sun was setting over the marina.
"Is this the way the world works?" she wondered.
that men get away with this?
As McHugh and I sweated our way through interviews with toxicologists, local officials, and residents exposed to toxic waste in the Central Valley, the number of Miramax and Weinstein Company sources willing to talk grew. At a bar in West Hollywood, I met with one former employee who'd worked with Weinstein closely. She said that Weinstein's predation had become enmeshed with his professional life. He would ask her to join for the beginning of meetings with young women that, in many cases, had already been moved from day to night and from hotel lobbies to hotel rooms. She said that Weinstein's conduct was brazen. During a meeting with a model, he'd demanded, "Tell her how good of a boyfriend I am." She said that when she refused to join the meetings with women, Weinstein would sometimes fly into a terrifying rage. Once, they'd been in a limo, and he'd opened the door and slammed it shut again and again, face contorted and beet red, shouting, "Fuck you! You were my cover!" Weinstein had assistants keep track of the women. The former employee had them all filed under the same label in her phone, FOH, which stood for Friend of Harvey. "He's been systematically doing this for a very long time," she told me. She took out an iPhone and navigated to a sentence she'd jotted down in her notes app a few years earlier. It was something Weinstein whispered, to himself as far as she could tell, after one of his many shouting sprees. It so unnerved her that she pulled out her phone and tapped it into a memo, word for word.
"There are things I've done that nobody knows."
That former employee put me on the trail of a handful of others. As June turned into July, they began to go on camera. There was a large volume of these types of meetings that Harvey would have with aspiring actresses and models, a former executive named Abby X told me, her face in shadow, as cameras rolled in a Beverly Hills hotel room. He would have them late at night, usually at hotel bars or in hotel rooms, and in order to make these women feel more comfortable, he would ask a female executive or assistant to start those meetings with him. She said she refused Weinstein's demands that she join such meetings, but watched some of them play out, and witnessed firsthand a wider pattern of physical and verbal abuse. X told me that her lawyer advised her that she could be liable for hundreds of thousands of dollars in damages for violating the non-disclosure agreement attached to her employment contract. But, she said, "I believe this is more important than keeping a confidentiality agreement." After the interviews, I arrived back at Jonathan's place and sat at his kitchen table, poring over transcripts. He padded out in a science-themed t-shirt with an astronaut on it. "Did you eat?" he asked. "No," I replied, still staring at the screen. "Let's go somewhere healthy or disgusting." "Can't," I said. It occurred to me that it had been a while since we'd done anything together. I took off my glasses, rubbed my eyes. "Sorry, I'm a lot to deal with right now, I know." He took a seat at the table next to me. "Yeah, all our conversations are about sexual harassment now. It's a blast." My phone pinged. It was a text notification. "Type yes to receive weather alerts," it said. I stared at it, confused. This was Los Angeles. Weather didn't exist here. "You're texting," Jonathan was saying. "Hope he's worth it. Hope he's worth saying goodbye to all of this." "Definitely," I said, and swiped the message away. Chapter 17. 666. As Harvey Weinstein's former employees talked to me, Harvey Weinstein talked to Black Cube. On June 6th, its operatives met with Weinstein and his lawyers at Boies Schiller in New York and delivered an exuberant update. After the meeting, Janus, the director, checked in with Christopher Boies.
"It's been a great pleasure meeting with you and your client today and to present you with our final report," Janus wrote. "We have been able to successfully achieve the project's objectives and meet all three success fee clauses, the most important of which is to identify who stands behind the negative campaign against the client."
He attached an invoice for $600,000. The contract with Black Cube stipulated that the success fees, Janus mentioned, be paid in the event that Weinstein used the fruit of Black Cube's labors in litigation or in the media, or should Black Cube succeed in putting a stop to the negative campaign against Weinstein, or should its operatives discover the individual or entity behind that campaign. A week later, Janus checked in again.
"Good morning, Chris. I was wondering if you could give us an update about the status of the payment."
This didn't get a response either. On June 18th, Weinstein met with Black Cube in London, and by Janus's description in a peevish email sent to Boies shortly afterward,
thoroughly reviewed our findings again and discussed possible future steps to support your client's case, who has again spoken very highly of our work.
As Weinstein sat on the invoice, his rapport with Black Cube strained. Janus would call and delicately say, "You haven't paid us." On a good day, Weinstein would feign ignorance and get the Weinstein Company's general counsel on the line.
"I didn't know that," he'd shout at his company's lawyer. "Get them paid."
But mostly, Weinstein would just shout at Black Cube.
"Why am I paying you? You're supposed to be on this," he'd say.
Things came to a head in conversations in late June. Weinstein questioned if Black Cube's work might have broken the law, leaving him exposed to problems down the road. He insisted that the operation hasn't solved his problem completely, as a summary email sent by a working-level project manager under Janus explained. Weinstein reminded Black Cube that other intelligence firms are involved in solving this crisis, and BC is only one piece of a much larger puzzle. Finally, in early July, Boyes and Black Cube signed a revised agreement. Weinstein agreed to pay a $190,000 settlement to square away the unpleasantness about the success fees, and Black Cube signed on to a new schedule of work through November of that year with a new, more targeted set of goals. Internally, privately, the project manager conceded that his operatives came short-handed on certain issues. In the contentious conversations with Weinstein, they had promised to do more. They could still solve the problem. They just had to get more aggressive. Each time McHugh and I acknowledged to our bosses at NBC that we were still keeping an eye on the Weinstein story, a new round of warnings about our lack of productivity on other fronts surfaced. Soon, McHugh was getting new assignments to work with other correspondents. Steve Chung, the NBC lawyer who had tempered Greenberg's hesitations about viewing non-disclosure agreements with, at least, a concession that there were shades of gray in the case law that might permit a news organization to do so, called to say he was departing the company. "You'll be in good hands with the rest of the legal team," he said. There were signs that we were at risk of getting scooped. As I made a last, desperate attempt to get to Ashley Judd, I called the New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who had worked on a documentary that featured both me and Judd. I had great respect for Kristof, who wrote about difficult human rights issues. I thought if anyone had a chance of persuading Judd to talk, it would be him. When I told him I was working on a story about the kinds of women's rights and human rights issues Judd cared about, he said immediately, "The person this story is about, does his name begin with an H?" When I said yes, Kristof fell silent for a moment and then replied, speaking slowly, "I'm not at liberty to continue this conversation." He got off the phone quickly. McHugh and I figured the only possible explanation was a competing New York Times story. I was glad to learn we weren't alone, but anxious to keep moving. When we told Greenberg, he seemed happy too, but for different reasons. "Sometimes," he said, "it's best to let someone else go first." There were signs that not all of the reporting would hold indefinitely. For months, Rose McGowan had been all in. In messages since our interview, she'd written, "I can give you more," and, "This needs to be a nighttime special, or a long-form morning piece. You need to come film more, I think." But that July, her patience seemed to waver. "I've thought about it, and I've decided I don't want to go forward with the NBC piece," she told me. My stomach lurched. She wasn't the only woman named in the story, but her interview was significant. I asked her to hear out what I'd uncovered before she made a decision. We agreed to meet again. I made the trek to her house in the Hollywood Hills one more time. She came to the door wearing a t-shirt, face makeup-free. She looked tired. As we sat in her kitchen and she made coffee, McGowan told me she'd already begun to experience the costs of speaking out. She said she'd told Price, the Amazon Studios head, that Weinstein had raped her. Not long after, her deal with the studio was terminated. Meanwhile, she suspected she was being followed. She didn't know whom she could trust. I asked if she had friends and family around. McGowan shrugged. She said she had some support. She and Diana Phillip, the wealth manager with the Women's Rights Project, had been drawing close. And there had been other supportive journalists, like Friedman, the former writer for The Guardian. McGowan told me she'd grown leery of NBC, uncomfortable with the delays, concerned about, she paused here, things she'd heard about people there. I asked her what she meant, and she shook her head and said only, "I just don't want to be morning TV fodder." I said that wasn't the plan,
that I did stories for nightly news as well, that this was the kind of story that would go everywhere, not just in the morning. I told McGowan there were good people at NBC, like Oppenheim, who had a career as a screenwriter and wouldn't feel bound by the traditional reticence of network news. But I said I needed to bring him everything, in the strongest shape it could be, and for that I needed her. Then I told McGowan about what we had. I said I'd encountered others with stories about Weinstein, not just rumor or innuendo, and that they'd agreed to speak, partly because they knew she'd come forward. At this, her eyes filled with tears. "I've felt alone for such a long time," she said. McGowan said she'd been thinking a lot, writing music. She and I had bonded, the first time we met, over songs we'd written. In her house that day, we each played a few demos. As one of hers, called Lonely House, played, she shut her eyes and listened to herself sing. "I stand for mind, for women who can't, and men too scared to beat that beast, to watch him drown." McGowan regained her nerve. She told me we could air the interview. She said she'd go on camera again, naming Weinstein more explicitly, and she volunteered, before then, to get on the phone with NBC's legal department and make it clear to them that she'd named him on the record. A few minutes later, I was on the phone with Oppenheim's assistant. I told her I'd had a break in the story and would be flying back on a red eye to see him the next day. I'd take any opening he had on his calendar. "We have it," McHugh said. "The clock is ticking." In New York the next morning, I took a winding staircase down into the basement underneath the Bank of America. It was a rare, old-fashioned vault, with a circular door with bolts around its periphery, and inside, a corridor of safe deposit boxes. A bank manager pulled out a shallow metal box. It was numbered 666. We stared at the numbers for a moment. "You know what?" he said. "I'm going to find us something else." In a less ominous box, I placed a list of our dozens of sources and transcripts of the conversations with them and a description of the patterns of predation and settlements. I included a flash drive containing the audio from the police sting. On top, I left the note of a person who was tired and genuinely unsure what was paranoid and what was practical anymore, but anyway, here it is. If you're reading this, it's because I can't make this information public myself. This is the blueprint to assembling a story that could bring a serial predator to justice. Multiple reporters who have attempted to break this story have faced intimidation and threats. I have already received threatening calls from intermediaries. Noah Oppenheim at NBC News should be able to access the associated video footage. Should anything happen to me, please make sure this information is released.
Chapter 18. Quidditch. Noah Oppenheim seemed speechless. I'd handed him a printed list of the reporting elements.
"Wow," he said. "This is a lot to digest."
It was July 12th. Outside of Oppenheim's office window, sunlight fell across Rockefeller Plaza. I explained that we had layers of hard evidence and credible sources. Some even knew Oppenheim. Abby X, one of the former executives who'd gone on camera, had recruited him to do an uncredited punch-up on the script for the Ryan Reynolds vehicle, Selfless. "We're going to take it to Greenberg, run it through the normal channels," I said quickly. "I just wanted you to be aware." He lifted the top page again, looked at the one underneath.
"Of course I'll defer to Rich, but..."
He put the paper down on his lap, sighed.
"We're going to have to make some decisions."
"Decisions?" I said.
"Like, is this really worth it?"
He was sitting on a beige couch. On a wall next to him, an array of screens flickered, news tickers racing by. Nearby, a framed diptych showed a game of Quidditch, rendered in brown and green magic marker and signed by Oppenheim's 8-year-old son. "It's a big story," I said. "It's a prominent guy admitting to serious misconduct on tape."
"Well, first of all," he said, "I don't know if that's, you know, a crime."
"It's a misdemeanor," I said. "It's months in jail, potentially."
Okay, he said. "But we gotta decide if it's newsworthy."
I stared at him.
"Look," he said, "you know who Harvey Weinstein is. I know who Harvey Weinstein is. But I'm in the industry. I don't know that normal Americans do."
"Roger Ailes wasn't a household name either," I pointed out. "Weinstein's more famous than that. And it's a system, you know, it's bigger than him."
"I get it," he said. "I'm just saying we're going to have to make the case to the lawyers that this is worth it. There's going to be a lot thrown at us if we do this."
From Wallace's paranoiac recollections, I knew that much was true.
On my way out, I thanked him and said, "And if an accident befalls me," he laughed, tapped the paper I'd handed him, "I'll make sure this gets out." "Thanks. Oh, and don't do selfless, too." "I don't know," he deadpanned. "I might need career options after this." That afternoon, I received another volley of strange Instagram messages with another image of a gun. I sent a text to Oppenheim's assistant, Anna. "Hey, don't want to elevate this to Noah's level," I wrote, "but do we have a good security person at NBC I could talk to?" I was dealing with some stalker issues, things that felt a little more alarming than usual. She told me she'd look into it. A few hours later, I got another call from Matthew Hiltzik, the public relations operative. "Just catching up with people," he said perkily. "You were on my list." Hiltzik had texted a few times since his last call, suggesting we get a meal, asking for updates. It was an uncharacteristic level of interest. On the phone that day, I told him I was still on book deadline and working on several NBC stories. "So you're still on the Harvey story?" I looked into the studio nearby. Behind glass frosted with peacock logos, a midday anchor silently mouthed headlines. "I'm working on a few stories," I repeated. "All right," he said, laughing a little. "I'm here to give you information whenever you need it. And I think it's really good that you're busy with other things." I got home that evening a little on edge. In the elevator, I started at a greeting from the boyish neighbor the superintendent always said kind of looked like me. Soon after, Jonathan called from a Bank of America on the West Coast, where he was finalizing the paperwork that made him a co-owner of the safe deposit box I'd just filled. "Don't lose the key," I told him. As we spoke, there was a soft ping, another automated message about weather updates. I swiped it away. As I got into bed, a text from Lisa Bloom came in.
"Hey, Ronan, are you still writing about NDAs? I have a new issue on my Kardashian case. You may have heard I rep Black China and K Family is raising NDA issue. Anyway, I'm coming to NYC tomorrow to do The View. Coffee, lunch, Thursday or Friday?"
I pushed the phone away and failed to sleep. McHugh and I had agreed to meet Greenberg at 8:30 a.m. I was at my cubicle, exhausted, when McHugh arrived. "You look awful," he said. "Thanks. Nice to see you, too." A few minutes later, we were in Greenberg's cramped office. "You have a lot," he said, paging through the same printed list of elements I'd handed Oppenheim the day before. Then he looked up and asked,
"Can I hear the tape?"
I slid my phone onto the desk in front of him and hit play, and we listened as Weinstein said, again, that he was used to that. As Greenberg listened, a determined smile spread across his lips.
"Fuck it. Let him sue," he said when the audio was done. "If this airs, he's toast."
We said we were going to proceed with on-camera interviews with a few more sources from Weinstein's company and draft both a script and a written story for the web. Greenberg, still seeming a little excited, told us to prepare for a meeting with the legal department. McHugh and I left Greenberg's office feeling triumphant. Later, Anna, Oppenheim's assistant, followed up about the stalkers. "Passing this along to HR, they deal with this for talent," she wrote. "Unfortunately, these things happen more often than you think." HR, in turn, put me in touch with Thomas McFadden, a grizzled ex-cop. "Pretty typical stuff," he said, scrolling through my phone in his tiny office. "Seen it a million times." "I bet," I said. "We'll look into it," he said. "Mostly, we figure out who's hassling you. Maybe we give them a little call. They stop what they're doing. Once in a blue moon, maybe we call up our friends in law enforcement." "Thanks," I said. "I feel like there's maybe other things happening than just the crazies. Weird spam texts. This sense like you're being followed?" I laughed. "Well," I said. He leaned back, seemed to chew this over. Then he eyed me sympathetically. "You're under a lot of pressure. Leave it to me and get some rest." All that month, McGowan and her new friend, Diana Phillip of Rubin Capital Partners, exchanged emails and calls. Whatever coast McGowan was on, Phillip always seemed to be there. A few days after my meeting with Oppenheim, they had a girls' night out at the Peninsula in New York. Prompted by Phillip's gentle questioning, McGowan spoke frankly about her efforts to go public with her rape allegation. She even revealed that she'd been talking to a reporter from NBC News. All the while, Phillip sat close, listening intently, sympathy etched on her face. The same day, Sarah Ness, the investigator at Jack Palladino's firm in San Francisco, sent another email to Harvey Weinstein. It contained another, more detailed dossier. Across 15 pages,
The investigators exhaustively retraced my steps in the preceding months, identifying many of my sources. The dossier concluded that I'd been in touch with Shiora, who HW confirmed was a potential adverse source. The list of reporters, too, had expanded. The dossier mentioned Kim Masters, the pugnacious writer from The Hollywood Reporter, and Nicholas Kristof, and Ben Wallace. It concluded that Wallace was possibly helping to direct Farrow. There was a final new area of focus, a writer for the New York Times named Jody Cantor. The dossier identified several of Weinstein's double agents, who had spoken to me, then reported back to him on my activities. The producer in Australia with the strain in her voice was one of them. She had alerted HW to Farrow's contact, the document said, did not offer any negative info about HW to Farrow. And there were other, more veiled references to collaborators. The dossier noted that someone identified only as LB had been involved in Weinstein's effort to ferret out information, quietly talking to at least one lawyer an accuser consulted. Investigation is continuing, the dossier concluded. We kept encountering sources who threw us off the scent or reported back to Weinstein. But we were also finding more and more who were willing to stand up to him. A former assistant who'd been assigned to Weinstein part-time during his trips to London and told me he'd sexually harassed her, initially felt talking wasn't worth the risk of retribution. Her fears deepened as Weinstein's associates began calling her quite ferociously after 20 years of radio silence. "It's very unsettling," she told me. "He is on your tail." But, paradoxically, the calls had made her want to help. "I didn't want to talk," she said. "But then, hearing from him, it made me angry. Angry that he still thinks he can silence people."
The part-time assistant also knew about Zelda Perkins, the woman who had spoken with Oletta, and about the joint sexual harassment settlement Perkins had secured alongside her colleague, Rowena Chu.
So did Katrina Wolf, a former assistant at Miramax who later became an executive. Wolf went on camera that month with her face in shadow.
"While working at Miramax, I became directly aware of two female employees of the company who had accused Harvey Weinstein of sexual assault and whose cases were settled," Wolf told me.
It wasn't hearsay. She directly witnessed the planning and execution of the transaction. One night in 1998, Weinstein had barreled into the office looking for Steve Hutensky, a Miramax lawyer dubbed the cleaner-upper among Weinstein's underlings. For 45 minutes, the two men had huddled, Weinstein's anxious voice audible to staffers nearby.
Afterward, Hutensky had ordered assistants to pull the personnel files of Perkins, who was then an assistant to Donna Gelati, the Shakespeare in Love producer, and Chu.
In the following days and weeks, Weinstein exchanged frantic calls with his advisors, including elite New York lawyer Herb Wachtel. "When I was a law student, Wachtel's firm was the holy grail of summer associateships. I'd been devastated in the way only students can be when it rejected my application. I had to slum it at Davis Polk like an ambulance chaser or President Grover Cleveland." Wachtel and Hutensky had sought an English lawyer for Weinstein. Hutensky requested the best criminal defense attorney in England. And then Weinstein had gotten on a Concorde flight to London to deal with the problem personally. "I was edging closer to rendering the London settlements reportable." The circle of on-camera interviews kept widening. A few days after the interview with Wolf, I conducted another with a former assistant and producer at the Weinstein Company. He made it clear that the pattern of harassment complaints hadn't stopped after the 90s. In more recent years, he'd been tasked with bringing young women into the honeypot meetings described by the other former employees. Some of the women seemed not aware of the nature of those meetings, and were definitely scared, he said. He was also sometimes troubled by the aftermath of such meetings. You'd see women who would come out of the room and all of a sudden there would be a giant need to, I don't want to say handle the situation, but make sure they felt they were rewarded or compensated professionally for what had just happened, he recalled. And those women seemed pretty freaked out. Weinstein, he said, was predatory and above the law that applies to most of us and should apply to all of us. We shot the interview at the Four Seasons in Beverly Hills with McHugh and me and a freelance shooter named Jean-Bernard Rudigarama, crammed into a small room alongside our lights and tripods and cameras. That month, Black Cube circulated the latest version of a list of names. A project manager reviewed the list at Black Cube's satellite office in London, half a floor in a glass tower on Ropemaker Street, where the art on the walls featured silhouetted operatives looming over bustling cityscapes. Then the project manager forwarded the list to a network of contacts around the world. The list contained many of the same names, and in some cases the same language, from the dossiers generated by Jack Palladino's firm. But the research had grown deeper, too. Now, secondary sources who had corroborated McGowan's or Nestor's or Gutierrez's stories were also targets. As the summer wore on, the list grew, with highlights appearing in yellow and then red to indicate urgency. Some of the names on it were spun out into separate profiles. Soon after the interview at the Four Seasons, one such profile, marked J.B. Rudigarama, landed in the same inboxes. A subhead explained, "Relevance, cameraman that is working with Ronan Farrow and Rich McHugh on the HW report." The profile covered Rudigarama's upbringing in Rwanda and explored ways to approach him. Its formatting was distinctive, with headers in blue italic Times New Roman and English as a second language malapropisms. Among the contacts to whom the Black Cube project manager sent the list and the profile of Rudigarama was Seth Friedman, the former writer for The Guardian. Chapter 19. Spiral. That July, I called back Oletta and told him I had more information about the settlements in London. I asked if there was anything else he could show me to help shore up my reporting. To my surprise, he said, "Actually, yes." He'd given all his reporter's notebooks, printed documents, and tapes to the New York Public Library. The collection remained closed to the public, but he said I could take a look. The Oletta files were housed in the reading room for rare books and manuscripts beyond the Great Hall. It was a dim chamber with sealed glass shelves and rows of low desks that glowed under reading lights. The library possessed more than 60 large cardboard boxes of Oletta's papers, all told. McHugh and I signed in, and a librarian brought out the boxes. McHugh and I each took a box and began poring over their contents. Oletta didn't have nearly as much as we did, but he had grasped at essential pieces of the puzzle. It was strange seeing notes from 15 years earlier that covered such similar ground. Even then, Oletta was encountering abandoned reporting jobs. On one page of notes, he had scrawled in Dr. Illegible blue cursive, "David Carr, believes sexual harassment." In Oletta's spiral-bound reporter's notebooks, I found clues that led me to other clues and which synced up with my emerging picture of what had happened between Weinstein and the two assistants in London. In the late 90s, Perkins had started working as an assistant to Gelati. In practice, this meant working for Weinstein much of the time. "From my very first time left alone with Harvey," she told me later, "I had to deal with him being present either in his underpants or totally naked." He'd try to pull her into bed. Perkins was petite and blonde and looked younger than her years, but she also had a sharp personality and was, even then, defiantly assertive. Weinstein never succeeded in his physical advances. The unending fusillade of attempts, though, exhausted her. And soon he was wearing her down in other ways. Like so many of Weinstein's former employees, she found herself cast as a facilitator of sexual liaisons with aspiring actresses and models.
"We had to bring girls to him," she said, "though I wasn't aware of it at first. I was a honeypot."
Weinstein would ask her to buy condoms for him and clean up after hotel room meetings with the young women. It was 1998 when Perkins got the green light to hire an assistant of her own, something she hoped would put some distance between her and Weinstein. She warned candidates for the job that Weinstein would make sexual advances. She even rejected
very overtly attractive applicants, because I knew he'd never leave them alone. It would never stop.
In the end, she chose Chu, a prodigiously bright Oxford graduate who would overcome paralyzing fears of retaliation and make her name public only years later. At the Hotel Excelsior during the Venice Film Festival in September 1998, Chu emerged from a meeting with Weinstein in his hotel room, shaking and crying, saying he had pushed her against a bed and attempted to assault her.
Perkins confronted Weinstein, interrupting a lunch meeting with a prominent director on the hotel terrace.
"He stood there and he lied and lied and lied," Perkins recalled. "I said, 'Harvey, you are lying.' And he said, 'I'm not lying. I swear on the lives of my children.'"
Chu was, Perkins said, shocked and in a traumatized state, and too frightened to go to the police.
The difficulty of reporting the allegation was deepened by their location at the time, Venice's Lido Island.
"I didn't know who I would go to," Perkins recalled. "The security guard in the hotel."
Perkins did what she could to ensure that Chu was kept away from Weinstein for the remainder of the trip. After returning to England, Perkins notified Gelati, who gave her a referral to an employment attorney. Eventually, Perkins and Chu sent notice that they were resigning from Miramax and pursuing legal action. Their departure from the company set in motion the frenetic meetings at Miramax that Wolf had described to me. Weinstein and other executives called Perkins again and again. The night she resigned, she received 17 calls of increasing desperation from them.
In the messages, Weinstein veered between pleading and menacing.
"Please, please, 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 please call me. I'm begging you," he said in one of the messages.
Perkins and Chu hired lawyers from the London-based firm Simons, Muirhead, and Burton.
Perkins initially pushed back on accepting what she called blood money and inquired about going to the police or to Disney, Miramax's parent company. But the attorneys seemed intent on foreclosing any outcome except a settlement and a non-disclosure agreement.
In the end, she and Chu accepted a settlement of £250,000 to be evenly split between them.
Weinstein's brother, Bob, cut the check to the women's law firm, obscuring the transaction from Disney and distancing it from Harvey. In an exhausting 4-day negotiation process, Perkins prevailed in adding provisions to the contract that she hoped would change Weinstein's behavior. The agreement mandated the appointment of 3 handlers, 1 an attorney, to respond to sexual harassment allegations at Miramax. The company was obligated to provide proof that Weinstein was receiving counseling for 3 years or as long as his therapist deems necessary. The agreement also required Miramax to report Weinstein's behavior to Disney and fire him if a subsequent sexual harassment settlement was reached in the following 2 years.
The company implemented the human resources changes, but other parts of the agreement were not enforced. Perkins pressed for months, then gave up.
"I was exhausted. I was humiliated. I couldn't work in the industry in the UK because the stories that were going around about what had happened made it impossible," she recalled.
In the end, she moved to Central America. She'd had enough.
"Money and power enabled, and the legal system has enabled," she eventually told me. "Ultimately, the reason Harvey Weinstein followed the route he did is because he was allowed to, and that's our fault. As a culture, that's our fault."
Oletta hadn't captured all the details of the story, but he'd gotten the bones of it right. I looked at his meticulously organized notes and felt, for a moment, emotional about the dusty boxes and the old secrets they held. I wanted badly to believe that news didn't die, even when it was beaten back for so many years. As I finished both our script for television and a 6,000-word written story for the NBC News website, the ghosts of reporting attempts past seemed to gather. In late July, I finally called Janice Min, the former Hollywood Reporter editor. She was fierce in her belief that the story was real, and doubtful as to whether it would ever break. Min had come to the Hollywood Reporter from Us Weekly, but her roots were as a crime journalist for the Reporter-Dispatch in New York. "We all knew it was true," she told me, "but we never got it over the finish line. Everyone was always too afraid to talk." She said she'd connect me with Kim Masters, the writer who'd worked on the story during Min's time at the magazine.
"It's an impossible story," Min said before we got off the phone that day. "It's the white whale of journalism."
"White whale," McHugh texted later that day. "Great frickin' title."
Masters was invariably described as a veteran media journalist, which she joked was a euphemistic way to call her old. She'd worked as a staff writer for the Washington Post and a contributor for Vanity Fair, Time, and Esquire. She told me she'd heard the rumors about Weinstein forever. Once, years earlier, she'd even confronted him about them.
"Why are you writing this shit about me?"
he'd roared at her at a lunch at the Peninsula in Beverly Hills.
"Why do you say that I'm a bully?"
"Well, Harvey," Masters recalled telling him, "I hear you rape women.
Sometimes you have sex with a woman who's not your wife, and there's a disagreement about what's happened, and you just have to write a check to make it go away,"
Weinstein replied calmly. Hiltzik, the public relations operative, was also there that day. Masters recalled him looking shocked. He'd later deny that he heard her mention rape. Masters wasn't convinced so much had changed all those years later,
A few months earlier, she'd worked on a story about an accusation of sexual harassment against Roy Price, the Amazon Studios executive who had canned McGowan's deal, and a figure around whom such claims had long circulated. But The Hollywood Reporter, where Masters had written articles for 7 years, had passed on the story. That summer, she was still trying to rescue it, shopping it to BuzzFeed and then to The Daily Beast. Price had hired Charles Harder, the same gawker-slaying attorney Weinstein was using, to approach the outlets. "One of these days," Masters told me wearily, "the dam is going to have to break." I came back to Ken Oletta and asked him if he'd give an interview. For us, putting a print reporter who'd worked on a story on camera was routine. For him, it felt like an extraordinary step, relitigating old reporting. But when I told him what we had, including the audio of Weinstein's confession, he said he'd make an exception. We arrived at Oletta's home on Long Island in the midst of a torrential downpour and hauled in our equipment through the rain. He confirmed that he'd seen evidence of the London settlements and concluded, as we had, that Weinstein had routinely purchased women's silence. And Oletta spoke of his quixotic returns to the topic over the decades. Running the story was important, he said, to maybe stop him from doing it again. Oletta, unprompted, looked at the camera. "Tell Andy Lack, who's a friend of mine, he should publish this story. He will." "Okay," I said. "If NBC, which has the evidence, doesn't go forward with this story, it's a scandal." Our shooter exchanged a nervous glance with McHugh. I told Oletta that I was sure NBC would run it. "Well, you better hurry," he replied. "If the Times is on it..." "I know," I said, and we both looked out of his living room at the storm. The same day, Diana Phillip followed up with Rose McGowan.
"I'm back home and just wanted to thank you again for the wonderful evening," she wrote. "It's always a pleasure seeing you and spending time with you. I sincerely hope I'll be back soon and that this time we'll have more time."
And then she came to the point.
"I was thinking about Ronan Farrow, who you mentioned during our meeting. I still cannot get his photo out of my head. Seems like a really impressive and sweet guy. I read about him and was very impressed by his work, despite the problematic family connection. I was thinking that someone like him could be an interesting and valuable addition to our project, not for the conference, but the annual activity through 2018, due to the fact that he's a pro female male,"
Philip continued.
"Do you think you could introduce us in order to look into this opportunity further?"